we didn't put these geese here. Now, they're everywhere, you know? And so it just goes to show you what a little bit of work can do.
Cleaning up the battlefields on Attu Island. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, October 19th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a charity slave auction in Sitka draws criticism from the NAACP.
Change the name of that event to something that is more appropriate and not so divisive and offensive.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
Alaska oil and gas have a huge impact on all of us, but how much do you really know about them? At akoilandgas.com, you can take an oil and gas IQ quiz and get the facts from reliable sources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
It's been more than 70 years since Attu Island was taken captive, setting off one of the bloodiest battles of World War II. Once they got it back, American forces transformed the last island in the Aleutian chain into a strategic hub that's slowly become a source of pollution. Now, as independent reporter Lauren Rosenthal reports, Attu is scheduled for its first cleanup in years, but it's unlikely the military will ever be able to turn back the clock completely.
Long before Japanese soldiers descended on Attu, it was home to a small village, and it was also a haven for birds.
Common eiders, they just make this cooing, and it just on a day like this, it kind of carries across the water. It sounds really cool. It's the red-tailed hawk sound of the Aleutians, you know.
Jeff Williams is the assistant manager for the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge. It's existed for more than a century, expanding to cover more than 1,000 miles of coastline and abandoned defense sites like Attu. On a visit this summer, Williams walks up to a rusted fuel tank just off Attu's Navy Cove.
It's just, you can see the valve right there just coming out. It's a direct source.
A viscous puddle of black liquid has oozed onto the ground. At least a half dozen birds have flown into it and died, their wings jutting out at odd angles.
Almost like La Brea tar pits. It's not thick, it's only a few inches thick, but just enough. See a carcass right over here. There's something right over here also. We found several carcasses in the past years.
This is the most obvious example of a much broader problem. Attu Island is covered with tank farms, fuel barrels, and pipelines. It's not clear how many have failed or how many gallons of petroleum products are still here. William says the Navy tried to decommission some of the tanks they installed for a defense garrison after World War II.
They burned a lot of them, and some pictures of guys with flamethrowers, just like literally going right up to the tank, and it's really remarkable to see this flamethrower just going on the gunk like this, just igniting it, and just back flames flying up, and, you know, I think we've changed some since then.
There's nothing easy about getting heavy equipment to Attu and then removing, you know, the volume of potentially contaminated material that we're dealing with here.
Andy Sorum is a project manager for the Army Corps of Engineers. They're responsible for cleaning up formerly used defense sites. After extensive research and an extra burst of funding from Congress, Sorum says the Corps is ready to start on Attu. Next year, crews will remove old storage containers and polluted soil from two sites, including the tank farm where birds are getting trapped.
We also are aware of a pallet-sized pile of old lead batteries, and we're going to target not only the remains of those batteries, but the contaminated soil around it.
The price tag for that work? Around $10 million. Sorum expects to continue working on Attu for years to come, but there are limits to what the Corps can do. Ken Andrashko oversees the formerly used defense site program for the Army Corps in Alaska. He says his teams have to focus on chemical hazards, and even then,
anything that's actually in a battlefield, anything that was released as part of the battlefield would be ineligible because that's defined as an act of war, and under our program, that is exclusively forbidden for us to go address.
The actual battlefield doesn't take up much space on Attu, but it casts a long shadow. After intense fighting, often hand-to-hand, more than 3,000 men died. Most of them were Japanese soldiers who believed it was more honorable to commit suicide than surrender. Now the battlefield is a national landmark and part of a national monument to World War II in the Pacific.
It's not like your typical Civil War battlefield or your European battlefield where everything is well manicured. These things are in a real wild state.
John Klo is a retired Air Force historian and author. He's also a tour guide, leading small groups of military buffs on an annual sailing trip to Attu. He's a big supporter of plans to clean it up. Klo says there's no reason why the whole island has to be wild.
Yeah, you go to a Civil War battlefield, you don't see a lot of junk laying around, do you? It's unsightly. You know, all this twisted metal laying around has very little historical relevance, unless, you know, somebody needs to look at it and make sure, though.
It's still being debated, but odds are a lot of that junk will stay put. As long as it's not leaching chemicals or harming wildlife, the federal agencies that manage most of the island aren't as concerned with debris. And after so many years, it's almost become a part of the ecosystem. Those birds are Aleutian cackling geese. They'd almost gone extinct before the Fish and Wildlife Service launched a huge effort to bring them back onto the refuge. But not on Attu. Billy Pepper is the captain of Fish and Wildlife's research vessel.
We didn't put these geese here. All we did was remove the fox from here. And all of a sudden we come here one year and you hear that, just like you're hearing right now. Wow. And now they're everywhere, you know. And so it just goes to show you what a little bit of work can do.
Pepper sailed back to Attu this summer, bringing refuge staff and a handful of scientists who wanted to study birds. While they worked, Pepper and a few others rode their four-wheelers down old military roads, pulling up to check on a small interpretive site they helped install. It explains what happened when World War II arrived on Attu. Pepper sits on a small bench, looking out at the hill where the final battle took place.
If you can try to let yourself run with the thought of what that would have been like for a 19-year-old kid, it'd be a lot. But they did it. Now it's kind of gone full circle. It's back to birds, you know. Little interpretive site here. It's mostly birds.
He shakes his head. There are some things that people and time can't erase. Reporting on Attu, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
A high-ranking State Department official will speak at the University of Alaska Fairbanks on the prospects of the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. Rose Gatemuller is Undersecretary for Arms Control and International Security. As KUAC's Robert Hannon reports, while such a treaty has yet to be ratified by the U.S., Gatemuller says there is broad international support for it.
It took years for a comprehensive nuclear test ban treaty to get traction in the United Nations. But with the end of the Cold War, roadblocks dissolved, and by September 1996, the General Assembly adopted a comprehensive treaty by a greater than two-thirds majority. While the United States signed the treaty, it never ratified it. We weren't alone. Other key nations also balked. As a result, the treaty has languished for nearly two decades. State Department Undersecretary Rose Gatemuller says the merits of enforcing the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty are growing in a shifting geopolitical landscape.
The countries who have nuclear weapons are really building up those capabilities, and so we remain concerned about what's going on in South Asia. We also remain concerned, by the way, about China's nuclear arsenal.
Gatemuller says the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty would block the development of new nuclear weapons and employ a network of listening posts to help ensure compliance. Without a treaty, not so.
But if a country decides to break it, as North Korea has done, then we don't really have the monitoring and verification tools to bring them to account.
Gatemuller will offer a lecture on the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty tonight at 7 p.m. at the Murray Auditorium on the UAF campus. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Fairbanks Forum member Marvin Roberts speaks publicly for the first time since his release.
This nightmare began in October of 1997. Then, like now, we four men maintain our innocence.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Alaska Pacific University is proud to announce two new bachelor degrees, Alaska Native Governance and Creative and Professional Writing. Learn more at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
A discussion after a suicide can help support vulnerable people who are at risk, or it can help push them in that direction. A lot depends on the words used to describe the event. Usually, those who take their life are alone, and most people won't hear about it. But four recent suicides in Hooper Bay and the very public death of a man who killed himself inside the Denina Convention Center at the end of the annual AFN convention on Saturday has Alaskans and Alaska news media grappling with the right way to report without sensationalizing deaths that result from suicide. Eric Boyer is a training coordinator at UAA's Center for Human Development. He says everyone in Alaska can play a role in preventing suicide.
We know current research in 2015 says that there's a greater number of people impacted by a suicide than we originally thought. Actually, past research said that six people were directly impacted by a suicide. In this year, we now know it's closer to 25 per person, which means there's a lot of people impacted. So when we pull together support those who have been impacted by a suicide with support for the healing and grief, that is directly can support preventing future suicides. We know suicide is preventable in the public health realm. It's not 100%. Their suicides can still occur. So when they do, we really want to take those opportunities to support those individuals ongoing, but also be aware of those who are around them.
Last spring, I talked to an Anchorage Police Department APD detective who said there had been at least eight suicides in Anchorage in the month of May, not statewide, just Anchorage, in 1 month. Yet there are no notices of suicides from APD. They send out Nexel alerts to the public on a wide range of accidents, road closures, gun violence, anything else practically that the public should be aware of, except for suicides. There were no news reports. Does this approach make sense to you?
No. If we never, ever talk about suicide, it will stay a mystery. People will not understand what it looks like or how they can intervene, and they'll think, well, it's the state's job to deal with this, or it's an expert's job. And the reality is a public health approach is only going to work if every Alaskan gets involved, learn some of the basic things, and know that they can intervene in a safe way to support somebody who is struggling with wanting to live or not.
So, Eric, what would you like to see going forward? Do you think APD should send out notices about suicide? What's the balance between not triggering more people to lean in that self-destructive direction, but still make sure we're informing the public of these alarming numbers?
You know, when a suicide happens, it impacts everybody. And generally speaking, people find out about it on social media these days. To kind of, you know, head that off, I think we find a way. I'm not exactly sure what that is, but I think those groups, you know, are looking at this, and I think they're finding ways that they're going to have to come to the table and talk and agree that this is the best practice for getting the word out and to support communities for healing and preventing future suicides. I think that's a critical component. Just in the last few weeks, I know these organizations have been talking, and we're actively playing a support role for them to say, you know, how can we move towards this?
Eric Boyer is a suicide prevention expert at UAA. Alaska's Suicide Prevention and Crisis Support Helpline is 1-877-266-HELP. A forensics expert is disputing boot print evidence used to link one of the Fairbanks Four to the 1997 murder of John Hartman. Independent consultant Leslie Hammer testified at an ongoing evidentiary hearing into whether George Freeze, Martin Pease, Marvin Roberts, Kevin Pease, Marvin Roberts, and Eugene Vent, men known as the Fairbanks Four, convicted of the Hartman attack, are in fact innocent. Hammer, a former Alaska State Crime Lab employee, says prints from George Freeze's boot cannot be matched to photos of imprints on the badly beaten Hartman.
I found no correspondence between the injuries that I observed, those feature shapes of the injuries, and any of the shapes of the shoe lugs as represented on that partial shoe impression.
Hammer further commented that the examination techniques and analysis presented at 1999 trials show lack of training.
Didn't appear to be some of the basic understanding of the discipline itself, basic application of methods or importance of scale in the examination.
Hammer's testimony, which included observations based on recent developments in the field of shoe impression analysis, was objected to by state attorneys as redundant of evidence previously presented at trials. The hearing resumes tomorrow when Kevin Pease is scheduled to take the stand. Marvin Roberts received a standing ovation when he walked onto the stage at AFN on Saturday. It was the first time Roberts had spoken out in such a public venue about the case. KBBI's Daisha Eaton has more.
Roberts described the Fairbanks Four as four men trapped in a nightmare.
This nightmare began in October of 1997. Then, like now, we four men maintain our innocence. I know for a fact that I am innocent, and I believe in all of my heart that they are innocent.
Roberts is Koyakon Athabascan from Tanana. He was paroled in June, while the other three men, George Freeze, Eugene Vent, and Kevin Pease, remain jailed. Three of the men are Alaska Native and one is American Indian. The men were convicted for the beating death of 15-year-old John Hartman on a downtown street. Evidence brought forward in recent years points to others being responsible for the killing. Robert said he remembers the night well when he was 19 that the police came to take him away. He said he was asleep in his room with no worries.
And then Fairbanks Police Department, open up, we have a search warrant. I could not believe it. My mom opened the door and the police came in and arrested me. I left my house in handcuffs, right in front of my parents and 4-year-old baby brother, who immediately started crying.
And he said the crying hasn't stopped for the men and their families.
To this day, I still cry when I think of my friends. I hurt for Kevin, I hurt for Eugene, and I hurt for George. I know they are in prison suffering right now. I think about them every day.
Roberts called the movement to free the four miraculous. The case is under review in hearings taking place in Fairbanks now. There was a protest calling for exoneration of the four during Governor Bill Walker's speech, opening day of AFN. I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
the University of Alaska Southeast, with schools of arts and sciences, management, education, and career education in Juneau, Ketchikan, and Sitka. UAS, a learning community on campus and online. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
The final vote tally in the Matanuska-Susitna Borough mayor's race indicates that Vern Halter is the borough's new mayor. Halter drew 5,422 votes compared with incumbent Larry DeVilbiss's 4,971. A special review team counted the absentee and question ballots today. On election evening, fewer than 200 votes separated the two front runners. Election results remain unofficial until they are certified tomorrow night before the regular borough assembly meeting. The Anchorage chapter of the NAACP called out Sitka's Alaska Day Festival yesterday, criticizing the name of one of the events on the program, the Slave Auction. The event is held by a local bar as a fundraiser for the local fire department. Organizers have agreed to change the name of the auction in the future, but they don't regret the longstanding history of the name. KCAW's Emily Kwong has more.
The Slave Auction is an annual fundraiser where Sickens bid on anything from homemade pies to house cleaning. It has been held at the Pioneer Bar for 31 years, and as with other activities that take place the weekend of Alaska Day, was listed on the program, both in print and online. Wanda Laws, the director of the NAACP in Anchorage, found out about it Sunday from another member.
Quite frankly, I had to sit up and I had to reread it because I couldn't believe what I was seeing.
The NAACP chapter issued a press release shortly thereafter, calling the event inflammatory and insensitive.
The NAACP is requesting that to change the name of that event to something that is more appropriate and not so divisive and offensive. I'm surprised that they haven't been called out on it before, but they are now.
The Slave Auction is organized by bartender Rita Ledbetter. It was created to replace a wet T-shirt contest. Ledbetter declined to comment for this story. Mary Magnuson, who has been assisting with the auction and is a former member of the Alaska Day Committee, said that there is no malicious intent behind the event.
This controversy, frankly, offends me a little bit, that people that know nothing about my community are pointing fingers and acting like we're racist. It's an old term. It has nothing to do with slavery. It has nothing to do with oppression. It's a fundraising event that high schools and fraternities have been doing for years and years.
Magnuson maintained that for her, the term slave auction is synonymous with a fundraiser. Laws, however, draws a line there, praising the event and efforts by Sitkins to keep money in the community, but condemning the name.
There are still people that are being bought and sold in this country, in different countries, for various reasons, which none of them are acceptable or okay. No, so it's not just about African Americans, but it's also a human rights issue.
$240. I'm looking for $245. Going once.
The auction took place at the Pioneer Bar as scheduled last night. Firefighter and auctioneer Craig Warren referred to it throughout as the Alaska Day Auction, inviting business owners to stand on the pool table while bidding on their services took place. Overall, the auction raised $3,000 for the fire department. Magnuson says she wishes that instead of sending out a press release, the NAACP had approached them privately. Laws claims that she placed a few phone calls but was unable to get through. Laws was pleased to learn that the name would be changed.
Within 24 hours, an issue that can be really emotional and very divisive, there was a resolution within 24 hours, and then we can, you know, move on from this, learn from this, and move on from this.
As of this evening, representatives from the Pioneer Bar and the NAACP chapter in Anchorage have not spoken directly. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
Each year, coastal communities in western Alaska watch feet of shoreline disappear into the waves. Now, a new online mapping tool will let them look at past erosion and see where the coastline might be in the future years. KDLG's Hannah Colton has more.
In the next 10 or 20 years, the waters of Bristol Bay will likely overtake much of Port Hyden's old abandoned village site. It's a fate that's long been obvious to residents of Port Hyden. And now anyone with an internet connection can see the water's progress over time using the new Alaska Shoreline Change tool.
On the west side, that's where the shoreline is about 5 feet away from that building.
Scott Anderson is the mayor and environmental coordinator for the city of Port Hyden. I spoke to him over the phone as we both clicked our way around the interactive web map. A satellite image shows a bird's eye view of Port Hyden. It's overlaid with a series of colored lines that you can toggle on and off to show exactly where the shoreline was during a given year, from 1957 to the present, with predictions up through 2035. Anderson tells me the satellite image is an old one. Some of the buildings we're looking at are already gone. They've been hauled away from the eroding coastline.
You see down where we have our most erosion, you see where the two white tanks are?
Oh, up at the top of the lake? Yeah.
Yep, the shoreline's up about halfway through that tank closest to the west.
A few years ago, Anderson called on the Alaska Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys to study Port Hyden's erosion. The village needed help to haul away old buildings before they crumbled into the bay, and they needed better information about how fast the erosion was going to keep happening.
So yeah, we did some field work for Scott in Port Hyde in 2013.
Alex Gould is a geologist for DGGS who created the Alaska Shoreline Change Tool. He says the erosion survey that Anderson asked for in Port Hyden became a model for similar mapping efforts elsewhere.
We then decided to be like, oh, we can, you know, start to apply this across the state.
Over the last year, Gould created clickable shoreline maps for Unalakleet, Wales, Kivalina, and four other locations on the Beaufort and Eastern Chukchi Sea coasts. He says to map the shoreline change over time, he mostly used aerial photographs.
A lot of the old ones were Air Force and Navy, and so they're taken with a plane that's specially set up to have a camera pointing straight down. A lot of these photographs are housed by the USGS and some by the University of Alaska Fairbanks. They went and they scanned all these old photographs. You know, we have to process the imagery before we can actually map the shoreline.
Gould says he chose to make an online map because some shorelines are changing so quickly his team couldn't publish print maps fast enough.
So with an interactive map interface, we're able to continually add data and allow it to be much more fluid rather than printing out a solid map. And so that'll be really important because the data that we're going to be getting in, you know, the near future, you know, year or two, will be incorporated right away into these maps.
Back in Port Hyden, Mayor Anderson is on board with that plan. He took photos after an early fall storm to give the DGGS team an update. He says the maps have already helped Port Hyden catch the attention of state and federal agencies who can help fund backhaul efforts. And the online tool is an added benefit.
Anybody now, I mean, just like you and I are sitting here talking, we can go, well, you know, you see exactly what I'm talking about. And I can give you a picture that proves it, you know. So it's a pretty handy tool. It's pretty awesome.
The Alaska Shoreline Change Tool rolled out last month, but the DGGS has plenty more erosion data to work with. Gould says in the coming year, he may add online maps for Shaktulik, Nome, and Hooper Bay, among other communities. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Lauren Rosenthal on Attu Island, Robert Hannon and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Daisha Eaton and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Emily Kwong in Sitka, and Hannah Colton in Dillingham. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
And by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Learn more about Alaska Pacific University during a 3-day weekend experience October 30th to November 1st. Experience the campus and Anchorage while discovering how APU can map out your educational adventure by attending courses, participating in activities, and interacting with faculty and other students. Register at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
Linfield College in Oregon offers degrees in the arts, sciences, and professional programs, and a rich campus life with athletics, music, study abroad, and more. Linfield College representatives are visiting area high schools in Anchorage, Kenai, and Fairbanks the week of October 20th. Learn more at linfield.edu. This message sponsored by Linfield College.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.